You're listening to Shortwave from NPR.
Hey, Shortwavers. Regina Barber here with producer Rachel Carlson. Hey, Rachel.
Hello, Gina.
So welcome back. Tell me what's on your mind.
So I've been thinking a lot about loneliness.
No.
Yeah, I mean, it's something tons of people experience. I definitely have.
I mean, same here. I also think about loneliness a good amount.
Gina, that totally makes sense because it's a huge issue. The U.S. Surgeon General even called the loneliness epidemic a public health crisis in May. And for a lot of people, it's something that's even more pronounced during the holiday season.
Yeah, it can be really tough this time of year.
And there are also some pretty dramatic health consequences, too. Loneliness and social isolation can be linked to things like increased risk of heart disease, stroke, cancer, infections, even early death.
Wow, that's really bleak.
Yeah, it is. So it's both this cognitive experience and a physical one. Alyssa Beck is a social neuroscientist at USC studying the basis of social interaction. And she says she got into the research because she's also had this feeling before.
I went through a pretty significant period of loneliness, as a lot of people do. In my transition to being a college first year, I moved 3,000 miles away from home. And I just remember how dark that felt and how isolating it was. And also trying to navigate, like, how do you make meaningful friendships and social connections in a completely different setting, away from home for the first time.
I mean, I totally feel that. I just moved, and it's definitely difficult to build new community.
I mean, it really is. And in more recent years, researchers have been interested in this idea of a lonely brain, or what it looks like in the brain when people are experiencing loneliness, and whether there's one unified understanding of what loneliness looks like in the brain at all. I talked about this with Laetitia Mwalambwe-Chilobo. She's a social cognitive neuroscientist at Princeton University, and she's done work on loneliness and social isolation. And when she was starting her PhD, she found a lot of papers that talked about loneliness looking only one way.
And when I was kind of starting out, it was hard for me to reconcile this idea that we had this very specific characterization that encompassed two seemingly different groups of individuals.
So loneliness includes people who don't have a ton of social connections and people who do have a ton of friends or social connections but still feel lonely. So because people can experience loneliness for all sorts of reasons, and because she was seeing these different types of loneliness, Laetitia and other people in the field are kind of contending with this idea that all lonely brains look the same.
And the more I started doing this work, what I realized was that maybe there isn't just one lonely brain.
Like, maybe my loneliness is different than your loneliness.
So today on the show, loneliness. We get into what's happening in the brain when people feel lonely.
And how it may change the way we process the world.
You're listening to Shortwave from NPR. Okay, Rachel, so what is loneliness? It's something many of us have experienced, but how do you define it from, like, a scientific perspective?
Yeah, I had that question too. Laetitia says it can come from a disconnect between the kinds of relationships we want or need and how we actually experience our social connections.
I like to define loneliness as being a subjective feeling of social isolation, and that it arises either when an individual's social needs are unmet by the quantity of their existing relationships or the quality.
Okay, so if it's a subjective feeling, that seems like it's kind of hard to study. So how do neuroscientists actually measure it in their research?
So there are a number of ways to measure feelings of loneliness, but because of this subjectivity issue, the most common is something called the UCLA Loneliness Scale. Instead of just outright asking participants if they feel lonely or not, they use a series of 20 other questions, like,
do they feel like the people that are around them understand them? Do they feel that they are happy with the amount of social relationships that exists in their life? And we ask individuals to rate on a scale of how often they might feel connected or disconnected from the people around them.
And Alyssa used this scale in a 2023 study. She and her colleagues were looking at loneliness and neural similarity, or how similar people's brains were and where they fell on the scale.
So what does that mean, like, to look at how similar people's brains are?
So in this case, Alyssa and her team used fMRI data.
That's the data that measures, like, blood flow changes in the brain?
Yeah, exactly. And they did these measurements while first-year college students watched short videos. So that was, like, clips of comedies, dramatic movies,
the search for deeper meaning,
even some more boring videos.
One thing again and again and again.
To see how similar their brains responded.
Like how similar those blood flow changes were.
Exactly, throughout this same video experience. So they were basically looking at whether lonely people and non-lonely people's brains lit up in the same ways or not, to kind of answer that big question we talked about earlier, whether there is one lonely brain.
Okay.
And videos kind of mimic a bunch of scenarios we could experience in daily life.
Yeah, I live through TV all the time.
Yeah, exactly. She says it's kind of the closest they could get to people's brain activity while they're just going about their lives. And this gives researchers a hint at how people might process the world around them.
Wow, and what did they find?
Yeah, so Alyssa says they saw that non-lonely people were all very similar in their neural responses.
Okay.
But lonely people had responses that were really different. Not just different from the other group, but also from each other.
Which, you know, kind of suggests that there may be these idiosyncratic ways of how their brains process and understand and incorporate information about the world around them that are uniquely dissimilar, which may pose challenges in how they are able to achieve social connection and feel connected with others.
Alyssa and her team are calling it the Anna Karenina effect, named after the first line in the Tolstoy novel that says all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Yeah, I've never read that book, but I actually do know that
yeah.
quote, and I love it. Okay, so where in the brain did she see these changes?
Alyssa said that one of the main areas was this set of brain regions called the default mode network, or default network, which includes a bunch of different brain regions involved in higher order cognition.
These are regions of the brain that are thought to be the sense-making or meaning-making areas of the brain that really is involved in integrating what we experience in our external everyday world around us with our existing internal information of past memories and knowledge.
So social cognition, or how we think about other people.
Were they surprised at all by their findings?
Alyssa says she and her team hypothesized that they'd see differences in higher level cognition regions like the default network. So that wasn't super surprising to them. But what was surprising was how different lonely individuals were, not just from non-lonely participants, but from each other.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of what Leticia said about how more research needs to look at why people feel lonely and how that changes the brain versus just having one unified picture of loneliness.
Exactly. Leticia didn't work on this study, but she says she really liked how it got at that idea.
What that study does very beautifully is really capture this idea that loneliness isn't just one concept to kind of capture all of the lonely people, but that we really need to start thinking about how there are individual differences in how people experience loneliness just broadly, and that we shouldn't be putting all lonely people within like one category, but really appreciate the fact that, again, this is a very subjective feeling and it should differ from person to person.
And I just want to be clear, scientists do see some patterns in the brains and behavior of people who experience loneliness. Like, other research has shown that people who experience loneliness are more attentive to negative social cues than people who aren't lonely.
Like how?
Yeah, so that's like if a friend cancels plans, as a lonely person, you might interpret it as something about your relationship. Like, if I equate those canceled plans with my friend deciding they don't like me anymore, instead of just thinking maybe something else came up.
Right. I mean, this is hitting really close to home for me.
Yeah.
Like, I totally felt this way.
Same. And Alyssa says this is one of the first studies to compare people's brain responses while they're looking at videos instead of doing something like a task in a lab.
Okay, but one question I still have, though, is do we know if people who are lonely already have different brains than people who are not? Mm-hmm. Or if loneliness changes the brain? Like, which comes first?
This is a really, really good question, and honestly one that's still kind of murky in the research.
Okay.
Alyssa says she and her team don't know the answers to it right now, but they're working on longer-term studies that will try to answer it.
Does she have any ideas about what it might be?
Sort of. She says she thinks it's probably a combination that people who are lonely do see the world differently than people who aren't, which increases the risk of future loneliness, but that being lonely also likely changes the brain.
Wow, okay. So then they probably don't know yet if the changes are temporary or if they can be reversed, right?
It is another unknown, but we do know that the brain in general can change. It's flexible. And Laetitia reminded me that, like, circumstances also change. 6 months from now, you might have more friends you're really close with.
So in that sense, it's not permanent. But I think the question is, if someone experiences loneliness chronically, is that change persistent for the rest of their life, or can they go back to something, to their original state? And I think that that question has not yet been answered by the literature.
Wow. Okay, so with all these questions, is Alyssa, who did this original study, is her lab doing any follow-up studies or more work to expand on what they found?
Yes. Since they did this study with first years in college, Alyssa says she hopes to organize longer-term studies where they follow students through all 4 years of school. And she's also interested in looking at how different people's brains respond over the course of a conversation. So, like, you and I are talking right now, but is our brain data matching up or does it look different?
One possibility could be to see, to bring these lonely individuals into the lab when they're interacting with other people, whether that be a stranger or a friend of theirs, and see if there's less synchrony when these lonely individuals interact versus two non-lonely individuals, for instance. But we don't have that data yet.
Okay, so I'm still thinking about something Laetitia said earlier and how some people who feel lonely might not have enough connections, but others might have like a lot of connections and still feel lonely. What do we know about that?
Yeah, that's something Alyssa brought up too, and she says the thought in the field has been that the more friends a person has, the less lonely they'll feel. But she says a lot of people with tons of friends still feel lonely.
People who have a lot of friends, but on average don't feel that close to them, are actually at higher risk for loneliness and also lower well-being compared to even people that have less number of friends, but also similarly don't feel that close to them. So it's worse to be surrounded by more people that you don't feel close to than less number of people that you also don't feel close to.
And recent research reported by NPR's Ritu Chatterjee suggests we need a variety of different kinds of social relationships, close loved ones, acquaintances, strangers, to improve our sense of connectedness and well-being.
So we talked about how people might feel especially lonely during the holiday season. What can we do to combat something like that?
It seems like it comes back to the strength of connection rather than the number of connections we have.
So even in like a big holiday party, whether that's in a work setting or in your family, kind of trying to connect more deeply with one or two or three other people may be more important than to try to get to know everybody and be in good terms with everybody.
That could also even be doing an activity where you might just bump into people with similar interests, like taking an art class or going to a concert.
It doesn't have to be something super complicated. It could just be reaching out and saying hello.
Rachel, thank you for bringing this story to us.
My pleasure, Gina. You are the greatest.
Before we head out, I want to take a minute to say thank you so much to our Shortwave Plus supporters and anyone listening who donates to public media. After all, public media means that you, the public, supports it. Everything you hear from the NPR network really does depend on your contributions.
And for anyone listening who isn't a supporter yet, right now is a great time to get actively involved in creating a more informed public. That's our whole mission at NPR. That's why we're here.
If you like perks, Shortwave Plus offers sponsor-free listening. And if you want to make a tax-deductible donation to your favorite station or stations in the NPR network, that's great too. We've even had NPR Plus subscribers make additional contributions.
What really matters is that you are part of the community that makes this work possible.
Teams across the NPR network, like ours, require resources to do their best work. And it's expensive to fund it. Microphones, laptops, and safety gear all cost money. And whatever amount you can pitch in today makes a real difference.
Please give today at donate.npr.org/shortwave or explore NPR Plus at plus.npr.org.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Burley McCoy and edited by our showrunner, Rebecca Ramirez. Britt Hansen checked the facts, and Patrick Murray was our audio engineer. I'm Regina Barber.
And I'm Rachel Carlson.
Thank you for listening to Shortwave from NPR.